We're going to spend the final hour of Fresh Air discussing the war in Lebanon, the background of Arab-Israeli relations, and the recent history of the Palestinian people. My guest is Gail Pressburg, the director of the Middle East Desk at the American Friends Service Committee. The AFSC is an internationally known Quaker peace organization headquartered in Philadelphia, which studies various political and human rights situations in the world and attempts to promote communications and understanding between feuding parties. It has, for example, organized public and off-the-record meetings between Israelis and Palestinians. The AFSC has been involved in the Middle East since the creation of Israel, when it provided aid for both Jewish and Arab refugees. At present, there are three AFSC staff members in Lebanon, part of a disaster assessment team, which reports back regularly to Gail Pressburg in Philadelphia. Gail has visited the Middle East a number of times, including visits to Israel, Egypt, the West Bank, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. The AFSC has published two major reports on the Middle East. Its most recent one, co-authored by Gail Pressburg, was published last March. It is titled A Compassionate Peace, A Future for the Middle East, and is distributed by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. The report urges all parties to be less rigid in their thinking and endorses the concept of Palestinian self-determination and statehood as a crucial element for long-term peace in the Middle East. It also calls upon the PLO to recognize Israel and renounce its goal of the destruction of Israel. The report is especially critical of the Begin government policy on the West Bank, where Israel now occupies territory captured in the 1967 Arab-Israeli War. The AFSC is also very critical of the present Israeli military action in Lebanon. From the AFSC report on the Middle East, which was published last March, this is a very condensed excerpt from the summary chapter. The core of any solution to the Arab-Israeli conflict is the resolution of the Palestinian problem. The PLO was in a position to make a proposal that no Israeli political leadership could long resist. It would recognize Israel as a state and make peace with it in return for Israel's recognition of the right of Palestinian self-determination in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. For Israel's commitment to peace to be fully appreciated, Israel must drop its claim to extended sovereignty over the West Bank and Gaza and deal openly and positively with Palestinian desires for self-determination and statehood. Just as Israel insists on its right to determine its national leadership, realism dictates that Israel will have to negotiate agreements with the leadership whom the Palestinians recognize, the PLO. That's a part of the summary chapter from the AFSC report on A Compassionate Peace. I'd like to welcome you, Gail Pressburg, to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Gail, why don't we start out, if you could begin, by telling us how the AFSC sees its role in the Middle East right now.
The AFSC does a number of things. On the humanitarian level, in Lebanon, we have a relief worker who is literally standing on the streets of West Beirut, Sidon, which is a city in southern Lebanon, handing out food packets with 15 days' worth of high-protein food supply where Lebanese and Palestinians come to the corner if they're in need and get their two-week packets. In the Gaza Strip, we work with the United Nations in a preschool education program for 1,300 Palestinian children from the ages of 3 to 5 in Jerusalem. We provide Israeli and Palestinian legal assistance for Palestinians detained by the Israeli authorities. On a reconciliation level, we've had off-the-record sessions between Israelis and Palestinians and Arabs from other Arab countries. We have written a compassionate peace in the hope that the United States government might change its policies because there would be public outcry around the United States for a changed U.S. policy.
Could you tell us what the disaster assessment team is and how it reports back to you?
A disaster assessment team is two people who've gone off to Lebanon, traveling throughout the country, southern Lebanon, East Beirut, West Beirut, and parts into the north. They make recommendations to us about continuing program. They will say food isn't necessary, look into the problem of housing, and one usually moves from immediate relief needs such as medical care, food, to the longer-term reconstruction and redevelopment of a country. Our assessment team of two people are coming back to the United States to make recommendations, while one person working through the Middle East Council of Churches, which has a staff of about 40, remains in Lebanon.
And how current is your information that you get from them?
Our information, I spoke yesterday on the phone, so we get reports 2-3 times a week, sometimes more often.
I should mention that a little bit later in the broadcast, we'll be opening up our telephones for listeners to call in.
Good.
And we'll give that number out.
Good.
You said in the report, A Compassionate Peace, and I think this is one of the main focus of the report, the core of any solution to the Arab-Israeli conflict is the resolution of the Palestinian problem. How did the Palestinian problem evolve, and what is the problem?
In 1948, Israel came into being. A war ensued because the Arab countries did not recognize Israel. In that process, some of the Palestinians fled from what was Israel, previously called Palestine, primarily in the areas of the Galilee, which is closest to where Lebanon is on the map, and in parts from Jerusalem and some other places. Some of the refugees were forced out by some of the army of the fledgling Israeli nation. Many of those refugees went to Lebanon. The Palestinian problem, as it's now called, is a way to find a homeland, a nation, a state for the Palestinians to live, where particularly Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza can enjoy self-determination. The Palestinians who cannot go back there can get some kind of financial compensation.
Now, the number of Palestinians who now live in Lebanon, that number's grown quite a bit since 1948.
Right. It started out in 48, actually by 1952, there were 100,000 Palestinians in Lebanon. The Palestinians reproduced by 100% every generation. There are now between the number of babies born and new refugees in other wars, there are probably close to 500,000 Palestinians in Lebanon. Not all of them are refugees. Some of them are in the body politic of the society, so to speak. They're grocers, physicians, university professors.
How do you evaluate the Israeli claim that the Arab world has encouraged refugee camps to nurture a group which would be dedicated to the overthrow of Israel, and in that way has contributed to the Palestinian problem?
Well, it's true that the Arabs have been unwilling to have the Palestinians become citizens of their own countries. Part of this, though, is the Palestinians' own desire to keep a community of Palestinians together, to be able to go back. Some of the Palestinians wish to go back to all of pre-1948 Palestine. I think that's unrealistic. So while I think the Arab countries have played some political games with it, I think the Palestinians have become a national movement. And with national movements, one doesn't find dispersion of people, whether it's in the southern part of Africa, whether it's in Latin America, or whether it's in the Middle East.
Well, one of the really difficult things to figure out in trying to evaluate this whole situation is the distinction that one would make between the PLO and the Palestinian people. And when you say PLO, that sometimes will get a very different emotional and intellectual response
exactly
than when you say is the Palestinian people. What distinctions would you make, if any, between the PLO and the Palestinian people?
Well, the PLO is the political expression of the Palestinians. It's an political organization. As such, it has been chosen by the Palestinians, such as a dispersed people can choose an organization to be their representative. I think it's virtually unrealistic to make a separation between the PLO and the Palestinian people. The PLO is an expression of nationalism. Many Palestinians, whether they're in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, whether they're in Lebanon, Syria, the Arab world, Europe, or the United States, will disagree with specific policies of the Palestinians. But virtually 99% of the Palestinians believe that the PLO is their representative organization.
Well, there's a whole model of thought which says Palestinians, fine, the PLO is an organization which is bent on the destruction of Israel, and I can recognize Palestinian self-determination, but I can never, ever recognize the existence of the PLO because this is a terrorist organization. How does that reconcile with what you're saying as far as it's really hard to make a division between the PLO and the Palestinians?
Well, I'm sympathetic to people who hold the views you just put forth. I believe that the PLO in negotiations, particularly discussions with the United States, has got to make it clear that it is prepared for a state on the West Bank and Gaza Strip committed to peace with Israel, that the PLO must recognize Israel during the process of discussions so that it becomes a government in exile rather than a military arm. But I still think, regardless of whether or not you like the policies of the PLO, it is still an organization that is looked to by virtually all the Palestinians in the world as their political arm, as their political representatives.
In Lebanon and in other areas where the PLO has a strong presence, is it more than a military organization?
Oh, yes. The PLO has a social service structure. It has a medical arm, which is called the Palestine Red Crescent Society, which has observer status of the League of International Red Cross based in Geneva. They have a complex educational system. They're the trappings of a government, which has an army and a Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. But the PLO, in order to have the legitimacy it needs to gain a political desire of self-determination for its own people, has got to say we are looking to negotiations, not military action, as the means to get what we want, and they have got to recognize Israel. There's no question about that.
Another very complex problem in understanding what's occurring in Lebanon right now is that there's so many different involved parties in Lebanon. There's Christians, Muslims, Palestinians, Israelis. Between the Christians and the Muslims, there's several subgroups within each group. Can you give us a basic overview and understanding of who the major parties are right now in Lebanon?
I will give a very brief overview. There are better books on the subject, which go into all the subdivisions for people who really want to study the matter. Essentially, there are, I would say, three or four major parties. The Syrians, brought in at first in 1976 as a peacekeeping army, have become an army of occupation. There's no question but that they also have become a political force. The PLO and the Palestinians are another political force. The Lebanese National Movement represents the essentially the Lebanese left, and the Falange Party represents most of what's called the Christian forces, which are essentially the more right-wing Lebanese parties. Now, there are variations within each side. One on the Christian, the Falange side, one can find everyone from the extreme right-wing philosophy of Bashir Gemayel, who could be the next president of Lebanon if Israel, and I think the United States government, had its way, over to the liberal bloc, which is headed by the Ede family, which is calling for a neutral Switzerland kind of Lebanese in the Middle East. And similarly, in the Lebanese National Movement, one can find differences.
Now, how do the feelings of these different parties break down regarding the presence of Palestinians in Lebanon?
Well, virtually all of the Lebanese, whether they're right or on the left, believe that Lebanon cannot become the Palestinian state, that the Palestinians have got to have a homeland somewhere else, and it has to be in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip if it's to be any place. Some of the parties, particularly the Falange party, obviously don't put a high priority on resolving the Palestinian issue. They believe that since Israel has the power, that if the Palestinians can be gotten rid of militarily, that's okay, where the Lebanese National Movement looks toward a political solution, not a military solution.
Well, you're bringing up actually two points. One, where the Palestinians should eventually end up. And you're saying that Lebanese sentiment is they should go to the West Bank.
Or they should certainly be out of Lebanon.
There's another issue which is brought in here, which is that, and this I think is not only true for Lebanon, but for other countries in the Middle East, that Palestinians form the function of essentially a cheap labor force. And I've heard some Lebanese tell me, and I don't know how representative this is of the Lebanese viewpoint, that just get the PLO out and that'll be fine. We'll welcome some Palestinian presence in our country because we need people. We need the presence. And essentially, other people have been saying this is because it's cheap labor. Palestinians are on the bottom of the economic totem pole.
That's not entirely true. I believe most Lebanese will allow some Palestinians, even though they want the PLO military out of Lebanon. The Palestinians not only represent partially a cheap labor force, they also, in many Arab countries, represent the cream of intellectual society, the university professors, physicians in Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Lebanon, Egypt, and they're virtually no problem. I mean, they're Palestinians who are guests and have passports in many of those other countries. So it's not only cheap labor. I don't believe that Lebanon by itself could exist intellectually, economically, socially, politically, if all of the Palestinians were to leave, because a lot of the cream of the society is Palestinian.
How does the AFSC evaluate reports such as one that was in last weekend's New York Times, that there's been a high degree of oppression and killings in Lebanon due to the PLO presence and Palestinian presence in Lebanon, and killing at the hands of the PLO directed towards Lebanese citizens?
There's absolutely no doubt that the PLO presence in Lebanon has created a state within a state. There's no question but that the PLO has from time to time, I don't think with orders given from Beirut, by the way. I think this is the excesses of armies have harassed Lebanese citizens, I believe mostly harassed and not mostly killed, although there have been some deaths as a result of that. The Syrians have done the same bloody thing. However, the Syrians have went from a so-called peacekeeping army to an army of occupation. And I ought to say that the Falange have, when they have need to get more and more support, they have used violent means to do that as well. There are certain schools in areas which the Falange control where the headmaster can't graduate high school students until he can certify to the Falange leadership in a local town that everyone has been through military training. The PLO does the same thing in the south. And there are all sorts of stories of rapes, murders, cars that are stolen, property stolen, et cetera, et cetera.
Just so we can understand and define who all the parties are, the Falange are, tell me if I'm correct, the allies of the Israeli army, or is that not a real alliance?
No, they are the allies of the Israeli army. There's no question about that.
There are so many different reports with so many different figures mentioned regarding casualties, number of homeless people, civilians versus military people who have been killed in Lebanon since the recent Israeli invasion. Who do you believe? How do you get your information? How does the AFSC decipher what's really going on with all these vast discrepancies in the paper?
That's a very good question. I don't know what to think of the numbers game at this point. At the beginning of the conflict, some of the International Red Cross workers in Lebanon issued reports, statistics of 600,000 refugees. The Red Cross, which is a reliable and neutral organization, now refuses to give statistics. I don't believe that numbers are adequate, can be adequately counted, whether it's refugees or numbers of wounded or killed, until after a war is over. In terms of finding out information, we have staff every place that there's a conflict, not only in the Middle East, but in Latin America, Southeast Asia, Korea, and in Southern Africa. And so we, by and large, look at for our own staff to identify reliable people and to be observers themselves.
In terms of how your information compares with the information given by the individual parties, is any one group more responsible for inflated figures or less reliable information?
Every party to this conflict will either overestimate figures or underestimate figures depending upon the political game it wants to.
So you really can't draw any conclusions about who's more at fault in that game?
No, not in that game, no. No. What I think is important to note is that the city of Sidon has been virtually destroyed, a city in southern Lebanon that we know that from Israeli sources that there are 9,000 political prisoners who are Palestinians in the south. There are certain verifiable war atrocities, so to speak. We know when the PLO opened fire against the Israelis after the invasion began that there was destruction in northern Israel, but that only one person died of a heart attack. But otherwise, I don't think getting into the numbers game is useful.
Do you read the American press or look at the news on television, hear it on radio? Do you take that with much skepticism?
I think at the beginning of the war, the press was more repeating sources by the contending parties. I think the press has gotten much better now. Obviously, the press recognized after about the first week of this war that this was a long-term effort and was going to be a long-term war, and beefed up the bureaus in Israel and in Lebanon and have ability to cover Lebanon from both East Beirut and West Beirut.
What do you feel are the Israeli goals in Lebanon right now? What are they going after, or should I say, what are they really going after? What do you think their goals are?
Well, Begin has made it very clear, Defense Minister Sharon has made it very clear, that the aim of this war is to politically destroy the Palestine Liberation Organization. Mr. Sharon has been saying this since last November. It certainly should have come to no surprise to the United States or anyone else that this war was going to happen. In fact, in Middle East policy circles, the debate was it going to happen in March or toward the end of June, which gives you a sense about the planning. Most Israelis believe, particularly people in the Israeli peace movement, which represents about 25% of the country at this point, that this war was not fought for security reasons, that it was fought primarily to destroy the PLO, because Israel does not want to have to reconcile with the possibility of an independent state on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip.
Do you see that relating to security considerations in terms of northern and eastern Israeli borders being vulnerable to terrorist attacks in the past?
There are very important security considerations in all this. However, in negotiations to the whole Palestine question or the problem of the Palestinians, whatever one wants to call it, the Palestinians could have self-determination in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. A small number of refugees could go back to those places, and whatever entity, whether it was an independent state or something short of that, could be demilitarized. I find it very hard to believe, with all of the ammunition and the high sophisticated technology that Israel has militarily, that they're going to be able to be threatened by a small fledgling Palestinian state or entity in process. Mr. Begin has said he doesn't want to give up the West Bank and Gaza for ideological reasons, which is very different than the arguments his predecessors in the Labor Party used to use.
Are there times where, or specific instances where the AFSC and Begin will part ways in defining what the legitimate Israeli security needs are when the issue of security comes up?
I'm not sure AFSC, because we're not a military organization, wants to define what Israel's security needs are. What we note is that there are people in Israel with very good credentials, people who were chief of military intelligence, who vehemently disagree with Mr. Begin, who say that we can have security and the Palestinians can have the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, provided whatever political formation they have is demilitarized. So I don't think we're trying to assess what Israel needs. I think we agree with the part of the military establishment in Israel that says it's possible to have peace and security at the same time.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Gail Pressburg, and Gail is the director of the Middle East Desk at the American Friends Service Committee, and she's also one of the co-authors of a recent report on the Middle East, which the AFSC has published. That report is called A Compassionate Peace. In a little while, we will be opening up our telephones for any comments or questions that you have. How do you evaluate the Israeli claim that they've tried to minimize civilian casualties in Lebanon by leafleting civilians and warning them to leave the area, by trying to hit military targets and avoid civilian areas? What's your view on that?
There's no doubt that they have at times tried to minimize civilian casualties. I won't deny that. There are also stories on the part of some Europeans who wound up being captured as political prisoners along with Palestinians in southern Lebanon, that when some of the Israeli soldiers wanted to inflict torture on Palestinian prisoners of war, that other Israelis in the same room tried to stop them. But I think there's a fundamental issue at stake, and that is when you send leaflets on a place like West Beirut, which was predominantly Muslim and predominantly Palestinian, which already has a refugee population that has fled from southern Lebanon, where are those people going to flee to? The Muslims can't go into East Beirut safely. There's just simply no place for those people to go. And so all the good intentions of the world have little effective result when people have no place else to flee.
Do you have any analysis of the Israeli military approach in their operation? Do you think that has, once the bombs do drop, has tried to minimize civilian casualties? What have your reports been from your field people?
Our reports from, and this is observations in all emergency wards in the hospitals that are coming in, not only to AFSC, but the Middle East Council of Churches, which is a Lebanese Christian organization, to World Vision staff, which is an evangelical group in the United States, which has been out there. All people who are neutral is that the casualty rates have been very high, that there's still unburied bodies in southern Lebanon covered with lime, and that one just can't count the numbers at this stage of the game.
I'd like to go back to what is at the core of what the AFSC sees as a solution to the Middle East problems, and that is recognizing the need for Palestinian self-determination, Palestinian state, a solution to the Palestinian problem. As we've said, as you pointed out, the Arab nations have recognized the PLO as the sole legitimate representative for the Palestinians. AFSC has also acknowledged that they should speak for the Palestinian people. Begin, on the other hand, just recently has said that there's no way, under any circumstances, he'll ever speak to Yasser Arafat or the PLO, and Israel recognizes the PLO as an organization which is dedicated to Israeli destruction and has been a constant headache on their borders for the last several years. Do you think it's reasonable to expect the Israelis and the Palestinians to reconcile these differences of how they view each other?
I certainly don't think they're going to reconcile their differences by themselves. I think the United States has got to say to the PLO very clearly, if you recognize Israel's reality in the Middle East, then we will hold discussions with you. So far, the United States has put that in the negative term. We won't talk to you until. And I don't think Arafat will come up with a political initiative unless he knows what he's going to get in return. Whether that's right or wrong can be the subject of another question, but I think that's reality for Arafat's part. I think the United States has got to say to Israel that the American taxpayer is quite prepared to pay for Israeli security and economic aid. We are not prepared to pay for Israeli expansion into the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, the Golan Heights, or southern Lebanon. And then I think through the United States, both sides can begin to negotiate their differences. I think, unfortunately, we're a very long ways away from that kind of process at this point, primarily because the United States seems to have very little policy toward the region, which is extremely dangerous.
What's your analysis of the attempts of Habib so far to try to bring a solution?
Well, I have a lot of respect for Habib. After all, he negotiated a ceasefire which lasted for 10 months, which everyone thought was almost a miracle. The problem is that Habib can only do what he can do out there. He needs clear signals from President Reagan, because no one in the Middle East takes anybody but Reagan seriously. Therefore, Reagan has got to make it very clear what his policy is. Habib is a superb implementer, a superb statesman in finding, you know, room and open moments, so to speak, for progress.
What do you think the reasonable conditions would be of mutual recognition? What type of tangible request should Israel make of the Palestinian people or the PLO, and what should the PLO tangibly ask from Israel that each party can expect to get so that there's recognition on each side.
Israel should say to the PLO, recognize us within secure borders, accept demilitarization, and look forward to a region of the world in where a Palestinian state, Israel, and Jordan can be a kind of Benelux economic model, a kind of cooperative model of three states in one confederation. The PLO ought to say to Israel, recognize our right to self-determination in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, or for compensation to the refugees, and then we will be prepared to recognize you.
What are the touchy problems that come up? I can think of one, which is, for instance, the future of Jerusalem, which is now part of Israel, but which is one of the more contested parts of the world for who should have rights to that city, ownership of that city, as it were.
Yeah, the PLO, all Palestinians and Israel are very, very far away in any resolution in Jerusalem. There's no question about that. The PLO is not yet ready to recognize Israel's right to exist. I think most of the PLO recognizes the reality of Israel, but they have to move closer to that. Israel's very divided about what to do with the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, which, with about two-thirds of the country believing that Israel should retain its territories and about a third believing that it should give the territories up.
One of the conditions that the PLO has made clear that they need to have met so that they'll recognize Israel is a right of return demand. What does that mean? What does the PLO have in mind when they say right of return? Do they mean going back to land which, before the creation of Israel, Palestinians lived on?
Well, the rejectionist organizations within the PLO certainly believe that that means being able to go back to Haifa, which is now a city within Israel proper. Many people in the PLO recognize that a right to return at this point is going to be for a certain number of refugees to go back to the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, even if they didn't come from West Bank and Gaza from the first place. I think the PLO has got to be much more specific and realistic on the right to return and not hold it up as a full-blown principle, because not everyone can return.
I'm speaking with Gail Pressburg, who is the director of the Mideast Desk at the American Friends Service Committee. And in a few minutes, we'll be taking your questions and comments. If you'd like to call, the number is 923-2774. That's 923-2774, and we'll be getting to the phones in about 5 minutes. The AFSC has condemned the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Why this condemnation, and how does it relate to what's going on in Lebanon now?
Well, from a humanitarian point of view, the occupation has not been benign. The Israelis have put settlements up on, Israeli Jewish settlements up on land that the Palestinians have held. There are a large number of Palestinians in prison under administrative detention. We also believe that part of that land has got to be for the Palestinians to have a homeland, or we will just have a future in which the Palestinians and the Israelis are at war with each other for a long, long time, which means the Palestinians, the Israelis, and the other Arab countries, with the exception of Egypt.
And I'm sorry, if you can clarify again, how does the West Bank relate to the solution of the current Lebanese problems?
Well, at this point, it's the only place where there's still a large number of Palestinians residing in what was historic Palestine, where the Jews and Arabs, Palestinians, Jews and Arabs, Jewish Palestinians or Arab Palestinians, lived before 1948.
Do you think that the presence of further Palestinians who are now in Lebanon and now directly or indirectly involved in a war with Israel, bringing them close to Israel again to another border area, isn't that inviting further trouble? How much of a risk can Israel be expected to take?
Well, as I said before, I think any return of any of the Palestinians to the West Bank and Gaza Strip in whatever entity or state that develops on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip will be have to be demilitarized. There's precedence for this. There was precedence after World War II when Austria was demilitarized. It's not a new political model for the world.
How do you think the Arab governments have been in their support of the concept of Palestinian self-determination?
Ambivalent at best. I mean, the Arab governments all say that they want to see the Palestinians have a state of their own, but when it comes to implementation, the Arabs have done very little for the Palestinians. And in some cases, in particular, the Syrians and the Jordanians, they've actually waged war against the Palestinians at different times in Palestinian history, Jordan in 1970 and Syria in 1976.
What would you like to see from other Arab governments now?
I would like to see the Arab governments come up with a peace initiative that says the Arab world is prepared to recognize the state of Israel within secure, internationally recognized boundaries in return for Palestinian self-determination on the West Bank and Gaza Strip. And the Arab world should make this absolutely clear so that it is clear to each and every single Israeli.
Let's take our first phone call. If you'd like to call and speak with Gail Pressburg, our number is 923-2774. That's 923-2774. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Okay, hi. I have a couple of comments and questions, but I would like to just give a very brief questions to Mrs. Pressburg.
It's Ms. Pressburg.
Yeah. The question is that you are talking and emphasizing on the recognition of the state of Israel from the PLO first. And my question is, which border you are talking about? Is Israel defined its border? We are talking about Israel has many borders. It has borders in 1948. It has another border after 1967 war. It has another border after 1973 war, which annexed the Golan Heights and took Jerusalem. Are we talking that the Golan Heights and Jerusalem are part of the border? Or are we talking now that Lebanon is part of Israeli border? Before we're talking about recognizing Israel, we have to ask the Israeli government to tell us where it is border.
I basically agree with you that issue has to be clarified. I think that when and if the PLO recognizes Israel, it should be recognition of Israel within the pre-1967 borders, not the Israeli borders that have occupied the Golan Heights, the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and southern Lebanon. There's no question about that, and I should have made it clearer in my presentation.
The second question, if you permit me, is you are asking the PLO to recognize Israel. The PLO is the victim. The Palestinians are the victims. How you can ask a victim to recognize somebody who created this whole mess in the Middle East and in the problem? First, we have to ask Israel to say it clearly that we recognize the right of the Palestinians who were driven from their homeland, Palestine, since 1948. Then we will ask the PLO to recognize the right of the Jewish people to live in secure border in Israel. You see, the Palestinians are the homeless people, and the Arabs are not willing to find solution for Israel by accepting the Palestinians as part of their citizens. As a matter of fact, the Palestinians refuse to become Syrians or refuse to become Jordanian, the majority of them, or Egyptian, because they are Palestinian and they feel that as a result of an international conspiracy, they lost their homeland.
Let's give Ms. Pressburg a chance to respond.
There's no doubt that the Palestinians are the victims of this. I do think that the victims in any conflict have got to come up with a clear political program that's realistic in the context in which they're struggling. I don't say that Israel shouldn't go first. As a matter of fact, I think the United States should first abandon its no-talk policy and start talking to the PLO, and the United States should recognize Palestinian self-determination so that the PLO can then play the recognition card with regard to Israel. But I don't think it's realistic for the Palestinians to sit there in West Beirut as Defense Minister Sharon is about to militarily wipe them out and argue about who should go first. I just think it's unrealistic in this current context.
Thanks for calling. We want to move on to our next call.
Thank you.
Before we do move on to the next call, I do have a weather advisory. The weather radar indicates a thunderstorm which will produce extreme heavy rainfall late this afternoon over northeast Philadelphia and lower Bucks County. This thunderstorm was moving fast at 10 miles per hour and will produce flooding in poor drainage areas. There is no evidence, however, of any winds or heavy hail. Again, that's a thunderstorm which will be producing extreme heavy rainfall late this afternoon over northeast Philadelphia and lower Bucks County. Let's move on to our next call. If you'd like to call us, the number is 923-2774. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
I'd like to ask how come a Palestinian state was not created in the 19 years that Jordan held the West Bank and the Gaza Strip?
I pointed out before that the Arabs had done very little, in fact, to help the Palestinians achieve their political rights. I will make no apology for the Jordanian role on the West Bank. However, because it didn't happen for the last 35 years does not necessarily mean it shouldn't be created now, provided that security can be gained for both the Palestinians and the Israelis.
Well, I think it's rather odd that that was not the case in the 19 years, and now you would expect a return to those 48 borders when that's 11 miles from Tel Aviv and 11 miles from the very heart of the country to a group of people who have hardly committed themselves to some sense of responsibility to the survival of another group of people.
At this stage of the game, whether or not Israel keeps the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, the Syrians or any other Arab country, if they wanted to, could put surface-to-air missiles from downtown Damascus or outside of Damascus where the military fields are, right into the heart of Tel Aviv, going right over the heads of the Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. I don't think land in this technological day and age has much to do with security. And a variety of Israeli analysts, military analysts, have said this. For more discussion about the possibility of a West Bank Gaza state, your listeners could write to the Center for Strategic Studies at Tel Aviv University and ask for a paper that a man by the name of Mr. Mark Heller had written on how Palestinian self-determination in the West Bank and Gaza can be satisfied with Israel's security needs.
I'll tell you, I really think that you should get another point of view as well, and you might call upon the Federation of Jewish Agencies at 16th and...
I'm going to ask you not to give the address. Thank you for your suggestion about the other point of view, and thank you for calling. What do you expect now? Oh, let me again give the phone number. If you'd like to call for a question or a comment from my guest, Gail Pressburg, the number is 923-2774. I'd like to ask you a question, Gail, about the book which the AFSC has recently written on the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
The AFSC in this book clearly denounces terrorism and recognizes the need for Israeli border security. It seems, however, to spend relatively little time talking about some of the terroristic acts which have occurred in the Middle East, acts which, of course, the Israeli government would attribute to the PLO. On the other hand, the report seems to spend a lot of time criticizing the behavior of the Begin government in the occupied territories of the West Bank and so forth. Why was this emphasis given in the book, not so much talking about terrorism, more time spent criticizing the Begin government? And please correct me if I'm
mm-hmm,
misreading
sure.
your analysis.
I think a couple of points to make. One is that we felt that people would be more interested in where the AFSC stood on the issue of terrorism, which we're absolutely unequivocally against, as a political means or any other means, then they would want to just hear the litany of details since they have been very well publicized in the U.S. media. We have criticized the Arab countries and the PLO in this book for failure to recognize Israel. However, the Arabs and the Palestinians don't have the West Bank and the Gaza occupied, and we felt that we needed to really focus in on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, because that was to be one of the sources of solution that we saw in the book.
I see. Okay, let's get back to the phones. I'd like to clarify the reason that we did not allow the last caller to give an address for another organization. We are really soliciting questions and comments and different people's point of views about what is occurring in the Middle East, but we're not looking for any organizational endorsement in the phone calls. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hi. My question gets to the situation as being more a Arab-Israeli problem than between the Arabs, between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and that the root of the conflicts, as I see it, go back to the artificial division of the Ottoman Empire at the end of World War I into a variety of states, which didn't really consist of real natural groups.
I'll have to ask you to briefly clarify the relevance of that
division.
Okay,
well, at 1948, you had a number of Arabs leave the area called Palestine at that time. Many of them left voluntarily. After 48, after the war, you had a number of Jews expelled from various Arab countries. You've had a tremendous interchange of tremendous shifts of population in that area. It doesn't seem to be really a Jewish-Palestinian problem, but more an entire regional problem. And to just focus on the fact of the Jewish-Palestinian problem seems to ignore the other realities which have to be dealt with in order to resolve this conflict.
You have a response to that?
Yeah, we have focused in this discussion on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Our book has a section on Iran, Iraq, some of the other issues, including issues facing the oil-producing countries. But I would say that the conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians is a continued focus in the region, and the war in Lebanon just reiterates that. I mean, Sharon didn't wage a war as the defense minister against the people of Lebanon. He said he waged a war against the Palestinians, against the Palestine Liberation Organization, to be more precise. That's why one has a conversation today on July 28th or 29th, whatever it is, focusing on the Israelis and the Palestinians.
Well, I agree that he waged war against the Palestinian Liberation Organization, because that is a concrete entity which some term a terrorist group and others term a national liberation organization. But the fact is, the existence of that group is a function of the other states in that area making it viable. Without Syrian backing in Lebanon, there would be no viable PLO other than as an ideological community. See, that's what we have to focus on, the entire relationship, and you can't separate out the Palestinian problem from the entire picture of Jewish Arab relations in that area.
Thanks for calling in, and let's. Do you have a response?
Yes, I did say that the Arab countries had to recognize the state of Israel. There was no question about that, and had to come up with a peace plan. There's no question but that the PLO gets support from other Arab countries. But the PLO, whether or not you like it or you don't like it, agree with it or don't agree with it, is an expression of Palestinian nationalism. There is a Palestinian national movement, and there are Palestinians.
Thanks for calling. Let me cover some ground that we had covered earlier. What distinctions do you think Sharon makes between the Palestinians and the PLO?
I think the defense minister of Israel believes that if the PLO was militarily destroyed, that Palestinian nationalism would be on the downhill, and that the plans by Mr. Begin's government for autonomy on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip would be able to go through. I don't agree with that assessment, but I think that's what Mr. Sharon believes that he's up to.
Okay, let's take our next call. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air. We're running out of time, so I'm going to have to ask you to make it very brief, please.
Thank you. Why have other Arab countries not taken in or offered to take in the Palestinians outside of Egypt?
Well, the Sudan has agreed to take in the Palestinians. The Syrians and the Saudis last week said when their foreign ministers met with Mr. Reagan that they would be willing to take in both some of the fighters and some of the civilians on two conditions. One, that it was part of a broad overall political settlement in the region, and number two, that if they took in the fighters and the guerrillas, that the Palestinians remaining in Lebanon would not be subject to attack by other armies and militias remaining behind. I had to point out that there are a number of private militias in Lebanon that could attack the Palestinians remaining there.
Thanks for calling. I'd like to read a bulletin that which we just received, which is that Israel has agreed to a request from the U.S. Mideast envoy, Philip Habib, for a ceasefire to take effect today in Beirut, where Palestinian guerrillas are trapped by Israeli forces. And this word comes from a senior Israeli foreign military official. Now, the assistant director general of the foreign ministry in Israel says Israel will observe this ceasefire if, as he put it, quote, the other side holds its fire. The ceasefire would be the seventh on the Beirut front. It follows seven straight days of Israeli air, sea, and artillery bombardment of Palestinian military targets in and around the Lebanese capital and guerrilla shooting in Israeli army positions. So again, a recent new bulletin that's just come out, Israel has agreed to a request from the U.S. Mideast envoy Philip Habib for a ceasefire to take effect today in Beirut, where Palestinian guerrillas are trapped by Israeli forces, if, as the Israeli director general of the foreign ministry says, the other side holds its fire.
That's very important. Any day that Mr. Habib can buy, have to negotiate, is a day we're more toward some progress in this thing.
What do you expect for the next 3 or 4 days? Earlier in the day, we were hearing about a 48-hour deadline for Mr. Habib to find a solution for getting the Palestinians out of Lebanon. And then there was a big question mark, an ominous question mark, following that 48 hours. What do you anticipate the next couple days will bring?
A very intense shuttling by Mr. Habib between the Lebanese, Syrians, Saudis, and the Israelis.
Let's take our next phone call.
Sure.
This is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hi. Why is it that for 19 years that Jordan was in control of the West Bank, no serious movement whatsoever was made to offer the Palestinian an independent state? Only when Israel is in control of that land is there such a consensus, as it were, to insist that Israel provide room for a Palestinian state.
I think I answered that question before, although in all fairness, our listener may not have tuned in. I make no apologies for King Hussein's rule over the West Bank. He should have allowed the Palestinians to have a state of their own during that time. However, in the current day realities, the Palestinians have to have some place to call home, a flag and a passport, in order to coexist by Israel. That's the only land that's at all realistic to expect a Palestinian entity to be on. And if one wants to see an end to this conflict, there has got to be coexistence between both peoples in separate states.
Thanks very much for calling. We're about to, we're running out of time, but I would like to ask you if you think there's anything about this conflict which will bring the Middle East closer to a lasting peace? Have things become aligned in such a way that just possibly there'll be some final solutions? And what would that demand of Israeli and Arab governments for those solutions to take place?
I think this war will only lead to some kind of settlement if the United States is clear about what its policies are going to be and that we really want to push in the direction of two states coexisting. Otherwise, I think this war will in the future bring other wars.